Therefore, the Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the Honorable Court.
Good morning, Council.
Good morning.
Ready to proceed?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the state. The Fourth Amendment is at issue in this case in Article 1, Section 6 of the Delaware Constitution. The basic purpose of both of these sections is to protect the privacy and security of individuals against arbitrary invasions by government officials. The standard that we look to is reasonableness. In order to conduct full searches and seizures, courts have found that we need probable cause. More limited stops and more limited searches can be conducted with more limited basis on the part of the state. In reaching these decisions, courts have looked to a balancing test weighing the personal security interests of individuals against the public purpose served by that search or seizure. The courts have identified law enforcement's responsibility for criminal investigation and the need to provide for safety of officers and other people involved in those investigations as a public purpose. In terms of pat-downs and minimal searches, courts have found that officers should act as a reasonably prudent person in the circumstances would be warranted in his belief of the safety of others in danger that the person they were dealing with may be armed and dangerous. Applying these concepts to this case, on Sunday, January 25th, 2004, Detective Don Pope of the Delaware State Police was assigned to a DEA task force, held a briefing because they had received a tip that a Michael Jones, who was wanted on a federal warrant for drug trafficking, would be at a Boys and Girls Club with people playing basketball on that date. He asked Detective Schiavi to join in and be part of that task force. They were briefed, and then they went to Boys and Girls Club. There were six or seven officers present. They parked in various locations around the parking lot and waited for Mr. Jones to emerge. After about 2 hours, a radio call went out saying that Detective Pope had identified Jones as a person emerging from the club with several other people. As those Jones and Mr. Henderson, who is the person at issue in this case, and another man walked toward a white SUV, as they approached the vehicle, the police radios went out, move in. Detective Schiavi, his role was to block the vehicle with his vehicle and to make contact with the driver. He did that. He pulled up in his unmarked police car with his badge held up to the window saying, "State Police, stop, put your hands in the car." Mr. Henderson complied. He was the person who was about to get into the driver's side of the vehicle. He dropped the gym bag that he was carrying, put his hands on the hood of the car. Detective Schiavi got out, put one hand on his shoulder, put his other hand on the outside of his clothing, felt, and then looked down and saw the butt of a gun. At that point, he yelled, "Gun," and handcuffed Mr. Henderson. Mr. Henderson complained that he should not have been stopped or frisked because there was no reason to stop him as the warrant was for Mr. Jones. However, this has to be looked at in a totality of the circumstances.
Let me ask you there, with apologies to those who weren't on the first panel, there was an issue that's still in my mind an issue about your statement in the brief that the trial judge focused solely on rejecting the so-called automatic companion rule. And in your outline of the law that applies to this case, you never mentioned the automatic companion rule, and now you refer to the totality of the circumstances. is the term of art that summarizes what you addressed in the beginning of your argument. Were you able to tell from the record whether the state ever argued the totality of the circumstances to the trial judge in the first instance?
Yes, they did.
Why do you think the trial judge then, as you put it, focused solely on rejecting the so-called automatic companion rule?
I believe that perhaps he did not look at, or perhaps he felt that at a first glance that there was no reason for the stop other than the fact that Mr. Henderson was a companion of a felon. However, I don't think that that goes, that that's sufficiently looking at the totality of the circumstances. And I would argue that the fact that Mr. Henderson was a companion of someone who was wanted for drug trafficking is in fact a rather significant factor in the totality of the circumstances.
But do you agree that the record in this case is a decision that said the automatic companion rule did not justify what happened here? That's what we're reviewing on appeal.
I would agree that that is what the Superior Court ruling was. However, the state would contend that that's not really the proper focus, and that the focus should have been on what the totality of the circumstances were, because that is the test, in fact, that courts have applied.
Can you articulate in a sentence or two what the circumstances are that the court should have focused on and that should have led to an opposite result?
Yes, Your Honor. The state would contend should have focused on the fact that the officer testified that he was experienced with drug arrests. He had made more than 200 arrests. In his experience, drug traffickers traveled with people who carried weapons, often as bodyguards or to protect their goods or even their person, that in this situation, the officer was unsure as to which person, in fact, was the drug trafficker. Although he had been to the briefing, he could not recall whether he had seen a picture. He did state that he had a description, although the men were generally of the same height and build and age.
Your answer sounds a lot like it's all right to do this because this person is the companion of a known drug dealer. And the reason I interrupt you briefly to point that out is because if that's your argument, that drug dealers travel with people with guns, then I could see where maybe the Superior Court got to the automatic companion rule as the basis for its decision. But you seem to be suggesting in response to the Chief Justice's question that the Superior Court simply didn't understand your argument at all, decided the case on a wrong premise, and that perhaps we should remand this to the Superior Court and say, you simply didn't understand the state's argument. You're talking about the automatic companion rule. That's not the state's case at all. But then yet, in response to Justice Jacobs' question, you start telling us that experienced police officers know companions of drug dealers have guns. So help me understand whether the automatic companion rule is in the case or not in the case, because it seems a little confusing.
Oh, first of all, I'm not absolutely sure there is a per se automatic companion rule. Courts have called it that, courts have said that, but if you look at the cases out there, they always have some reason other than someone was simply with someone, whether the situation they were in, whether the wanted person had a violent history, or was being arrested in terms of a violent crime. These are things that go into the totality analysis. Whether you want to call it automatic companion rule or whether you just want to call it a Terry stop, that's what we're talking about here, is a Terry stop. And I wouldn't see, the state would contend there's no reason to remand this because all the facts have been found.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So in terms of what the trial court found, right at the very beginning, the court says that without probable cause to arrest or reasonable articulable suspicion to seize, the only basis justifying the seizure is the so-called automatic companion rule. So didn't the court find that there was no other basis on which this could be upheld. So that's why the court then analyzed the automatic companion rule, not because the court ignored the totality of the circumstances, but felt that those circumstances did not justify the seizure.
That is a possibility. The court did make that statement in the beginning of the its decision. However, then it went on to analyze factors and discuss the automatic companion rule, which, in effect, it is really going back to a totality. And the state would contend that regardless of whether the court found that under a totality that there was not reasonable articular suspicion, the state would contend that finding was incorrect and that there was, in fact, reasonable articular suspicion that the companion of the drug trafficker was carrying a weapon, and that is a crime.
Okay, well, some time back you were interrupted, and I have written down two of the factors that you felt would support the officer's conduct. The first was that drug traffickers travel with armed, quote, bodyguards, and the second that the officer didn't know who this person was, that it may have been the person they were seeking to arrest. Are there any other factors?
The fact that Henderson was the driver of the vehicle who would be possibly affecting the escape of the felon, and that it happened in an area where there were a number of innocent bystanders and there were safety issues involved. Police officers have to make decisions very quickly, and when an arrest situation, particularly in a case of drug dealers, is a very volatile situation, as this court and other courts
have consistently found. We keep coming back to drug dealers. If it were a warrant for burglary or for reckless driving, are you suggesting then there wouldn't be a reasonable articular suspicion to not just stop, but to pat down Henderson?
It depends. I think the situation determines the extent of the stop. Just as, you know, cases have found historically that you need to take control of the situation. If there was a burglary warrant out for someone, if the police officer were aware that that person had a violent history, if the person were in the middle of a crowd that looked unruly, there are all sorts of factors that would go into a specific analysis.
Well, let's address control of the situation in light of the factors you just mentioned. Henderson was evidently the driver, and you suggested that had he been allowed to get in the car, he might have driven away and effected an escape, I guess either rolled over or through the police car. But at the time the police officer stopped him without searching him, that ended the danger of him driving the car and effecting escape, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
You suggested that the police officer didn't know whether Henderson was the person for whom the warrant issued. But once he stopped him, under our law, he could ask those four magic questions. What is your name? Where are you going? Where have you been? And what is your business abroad? Did that require a search or a pat-down?
At that point, to ask those questions? I'm unclear.
And to clear up the factor that you said was important, which is that he didn't know whether Henderson was the person for whom the warrant had issued. All you need to do is ask him his name or ask him for some identification, which is, under our detention statute, perfectly appropriate. That would not have required a pat-down. So no matter how you analyze the factors that you suggest make up the totality of the circumstances, it all comes back full circle to the fact that the warrant was for drugs and that there's an assumption, or an inference, if not an assumption, that someone who is a companion of a person for whom a warrant for drugs has issued may be packing a gun. That's the only thing that suggests that the officer's safety may be compromised, isn't it?
That is the reason the officer articulated that and the possibility of resisting arrest.
What are the other factors that either affect the control of the situation and the safety of the officer other than the fact that the warrant was for a drug offense and that this person was the companion of a person for whom a warrant for a drug offense had issued?
The possibility, as I just said, of resisting arrest of any person. The fact, I do think it is important that that is the issue, that he was with someone who is someone known to be violent, who, in a situation where he could easily have protected the person that they were going after by having a weapon. That was standard, and the police officer was aware of that, and there were people in the area that could have been shot. To expect a police officer to walk up to someone he clearly suspects has a weapon and say, "Excuse me, are you Mr. Jones? We have a warrant for your arrest," it is completely unreasonable. Police are dealing in a situation where they guns are out there. They have to be able to ascertain who, excuse me, who's who in the group in a safe manner. And if they act first in a situation like this, the chances of someone volunteering that they're the wanted fugitive are slim.
Can you articulate a situation when it would not be lawful to search the companion of an alleged drug dealer?
I think most situations, police officers are put in the place where they are going to at least stop, if not pat down, all people. I mean, if perhaps if they were, I'm hard pressed to think of a situation where the police could safely stop and arrest someone who was in close companionship with other people that he knew or suspected was carrying weapons.
So you're asking us to adopt an automatic companion rule, because Justice Risley's question was not what would the police do, but were the circumstances under which it would be lawful.
The state is not asking for a per se automatic companion rule. Such a rule would be that in any, absolutely any situation, no matter what the warrant was for, no matter in any case, that would be sufficient to stop and frisk the people around him. That's not the case. In this, first of all, you have to talk about companion and the fact that these were people getting into the car. Henderson had obviously brought Jones to this location and was ready to take him away. You know, the other option was allow them to get in the car. That's not a good option. They certainly could have stopped and pulled them out in that.
When it was Jones, you say it was obvious that Henderson had brought Jones to the location and was going to take him away. Where was Jones when Henderson was getting in the vehicle?
He was being stopped on the other side of the vehicle by other officers.
On the other side of the vehicle?
There were two passengers getting in, Jones and one other man. They were both stopped. The third man was stopped, pat down, had nothing, was released.
What made it obvious to you and to the police officers that Henderson had brought him to the scene?
That they were getting into the car together, that he was the driver. There was no other vehicle for Jones to be getting into.
Ms. McClellan, I'm asking you, how significant is the fact, which has been repeated in the brief and in your argument, that at the time of the pat-down, the police didn't know which of the three persons was Jones? But suppose they did know. Isn't your position that they would have been, it would have been reasonable for them to pat down the other two anyway?
Yes, that is the state's position.
So doesn't that render their lack of knowledge of who, you know, which person was Jones irrelevant?
I don't think it's entirely irrelevant to this case. It is a factor in this case that he did not, the officer was unaware. And looking at it from an experienced officer's perspective, his perspective, he was unsure. And
it may be a factor, but if that factor were not there, the result would be the same.
Yes.
So it couldn't be a significant factor.
You just told us that you can't imagine a situation where there was a warrant for a drug arrest and more than one person there where the police wouldn't, for their own safety, frisk everybody.
Perhaps in a situation where they could isolate the other companions, that where there was no one else around that could possibly be hurt.
Well,
that would be a...
Let's assume from the tenor of your comments that the state is taking the position that in cases of drug arrests, because drug traffickers are known to travel with guns and with companions who have guns, the so-called automatic companion rule applies, because you always have the suspicion, the articulable suspicion, that the people immediately surrounding the drug trafficker may well be armed and dangerous. Let's put that aside for a moment. Now tell me about what other types of arrest warrants there could be where the automatic companion rule would not apply in the state's view.
In the state's view, if someone was there was a warrant out for someone for traffic violations, forgery, in cases like that, depending on the situation, there
offenses that would not likely lead to violence or crimes of violence.
Yes, and on the other hand, if, for example, there was a warrant out on a forgery and the police were aware that the wanted person had a long history of other crimes that would lead him to strongly resist, and, you know, he was with several people that looked like they might assist in any attempt to resist arrest, it would not be unreasonable in that situation.
In this case, now your time's about up, have we come to the point where the state's position is the articulable suspicion was he was the companion of a person who was wanted for a drug offense.
And that he would likely be carrying a weapon.
For that
same
reason.
Due to that relationship, yes.
So then we're pretty much back to the automatic companion
rule. The state would contend it's not automatic, that is the most significant factor in the totality of the circumstances in this particular case.
Well, I don't want to
play semantics.
Exactly. But as I understand the state's argument, it is an automatic companion rule when you're arresting someone for drugs. There may be exceptions for other types of arrests, but if I've misunderstood the state's position, tell me.
The state does not contend that it would be automatic if it was possession of a bag of marijuana.
No, my question is, does the state contend it is automatic if you're executing an arrest warrant for a drug offense or drug trafficker?
I would not say it was automatic. I would say that factors like that there were other innocent bystanders, that the officer felt in this situation the safest thing to do was to stop and pat before asking a question. That would be a mistake.
So you're saying if this arrest took place in the middle of an open field, still for drug trafficking, and there were companions, could the officers search the companions or not? They're the only two people in the middle of this 100-acre field, no woods, totally open, are the drug trafficker who's to be arrested and the companion.
If the police officer believed that the companion was secured and safe, then there would be no reason that he couldn't hesitate before the pat-down, in my view.
Hesitate before the pat-down, so your position is you had the right to pat him down, even under the circumstances that Justice Holland just described.
If he believed that the person was carrying a weapon, that's certainly a reasonable articulable suspicion of a crime and fear of the dangerousness of the situation. The officer felt there was danger, he was justified.
Yeah, you have about a minute and 44 seconds left. Do you want to save it?
I will save it. Okay. Thank you.
Let me explain how I see my function in assisting here. And it's not explaining the law to you, obviously, or interpreting the law to you or for you, obviously, but it's to give you a hint of what is going on out at the street and to tell you how vitally important it is that appropriate guidelines be set. And I'm going to tell you my perception, and I'm going to refer to passages that substantiate what I say. There is much of this going on, and Officer Schiavi was very honest when he said he's made 500 or 1,000 arrests in 15 years. He does this all the time, and there's lots of police doing this all the time, and not just this meaning with drug people, traffickers, with people who have marijuana records, with people who have domestic violence records. It is rampant with probation and parole people that are not really trained, and they're out there on this task force looking for people that are on probation. And you can count on the fact that if they pull somebody over in a car and that person's on probation, everybody's getting patted down. It don't matter what you're on probation for. That's what these guys are doing, and it's happening all the time. I see it coming in my office and going out of my office. So this is the tip of the iceberg. The state chose the wrong case to bring this issue of automatic companion up. That's what this is, whatever they want to call the Trojan horse. It's automatic companion. I, probably a prosecutor at heart, I will say a compassionate, enlightened prosecutor, being self-aggrandizing, and I talked to the prosecutor, Mr. Barber, and said, you don't want this case up there. Other than the guy coming from a church, you could not pick a worse factual circumstance. The state was very confident automatic companion was going to carry the day. This prosecutor's not, another prosecutor was. The testimony of Officer Schiavi was very revealing. One of the questions was, how many arrests have you made which involved the target of an arrest warrant where there were other people around, some of the people that were around the actual target? And here's where you're going to get the interesting. Well, several. As a patrol officer conducting a traffic stop of a car, and then he changes gears, but that's his basic proposition. That's what's going on with patrol officers. Anytime I know an individual is going to be wanted or the target of an investigation, and he's with other known, other friends or associates, you want to protect yourself from preventing his capture and their apprehension. Like I say, I've been involved in, you know, 500 or 1,000 arrests in 15 years, and you know, and we try to conduct ourselves with officer safety as the utmost top priority. Every time he pulls somebody over, he is saying and said that day, they're going to get patted down who's in that car. Question. When you stopped Mr. Henderson, did you know whether he was Michael Jones or whether he was Stephen Henderson? Answer. No, I did not. It's also our experience that it's been my experience that you want to obviously check the identification and warrant status of any known associates with the person that you're arresting as well. This is used as a trampoline to be able to check warrants on people in the car. Very effective situation because oftentimes they find warrants. So they're getting people out, patting them down, getting their information, going back and running a computer check. And he says that they do that, and they do it.
This is really, if I understand your point correctly, it is that this practice of patting down, stopping and patting down companions persons who are the subject of an arrest warrant is being abused.
Yes.
And the abuse ought to stop, and the rule ought to be clear enough so that it will eliminate the abuse.
As part of my
assuming we agree with that, my question to you is, in a circumstance where there is a legitimate, reasonable risk from an officer's point of view to that officer's safety, when that officer is making, stopping someone who's the subject of an arrest who has companions, assuming that there's a legitimate concern for the safety of the officer, that at least, abstractly speaking, would be a situation where there would be no abuse, correct?
That is absolutely correct. And what makes it difficult, the squirrely part, is the distinction is brought up by the question of Chief Justice Steele between stabilizing, securing, and patting down. In this case, I don't know, and I'm not sure, whether or not it was not reasonable to say, Henderson, put your hands out here where I can see them. Secure them. The next step is a different invasion. I don't know if 3 o'clock in the morning a single police officer pulls somebody over and there's a convicted felony warrant. I don't know that it's not unreasonable to say, everybody out of the car, hands up where I can see them, you stand there. And that should end it, unless there's something more. I don't think that a police officer at night by himself has to just deal with one person and allow other people in the car. We're in a Maryland versus Bowie situation. Because of the nightness, the darkness, he could be at risk. I think he has the right to get them out of there and put his hands on without anything else other than there's more of them than me, there's one violent person or potentially violent person, and people tend to hang with their own kind. Therefore, everybody, folks, get out, put your hands on the car, let me see them. And if that, everybody's reasonable to that point and compliant, and there's no other flags to go up, I think that has to end it. They can't go the next step, but they're going the next step, particularly with kids.
So you're saying even where there is a legitimate concern about officer safety, the bright line has got to be, or it's got to end at the point where everybody's got their hands on the hood?
Unless there's something else, another ingredient, another factor, another point.
What about the possibility that one of those three, while they reach down while the police officer is looking at the other two and pull out the gun.
Well, then you got to go automatic companion. If you're going to allow for that possibility, then you have to say that just because you're in the company, that's what I think is being abused.
If we take your 3 o'clock in the morning stop by the single police officer, 3 people in the car, all 3 get out, and he secures or controls the situation at least temporarily by telling them to put their hands on the hood because there's a warrant for one of them. He doesn't know which one is the person to whom or for whom the warrant is issued. The state would respond, I think, by saying, well, there is one other important factor that would allow him to go beyond telling them to put their hands in the hood because that might not control the situation. That factor is the purpose for which the warrant issued. What was the offense? If the offense was a drug offense and it was one that was more than simple possession, it was one that suggested that somebody dealt with intent or actually delivered or trafficked in a drug, it's common knowledge that those people either carry guns or have people with them who have weapons because it protects their money and protects their stash. The state would say there's only one other factor you need, and that is the drug element in the warrant. That would allow him to pat down each of the 3, not strip search him, but pat him down so at that moment, till backup could get there, the officer would feel secure. Is there something wrong with that scenario?
What is wrong with that scenario is the degree of association the state submits between person is a drug trafficker, meaning they have more than 10 grams of cocaine, possession with intent to deliver, maintaining a vehicle, ergo, anybody with them is probably armed. That's where the logical leap is made.
Well, there's some of our case law that suggests that that's logical.
It is logical, but it is not necessarily probable enough in every case to say, okay, simply because of that fact, you're worse off with a burglar, I think, than you are with somebody who's got a possession with marijuana.
Well, you want us to draw a bright line. At least you suggested it, so there's some clarity for people in the field. Why isn't the best and clearest of the bright lines to say that if the warrant is for a serious drug offense, and the case law suggested that for those type of offenses, guns are generally involved or weapons are generally involved, why isn't the clear, easy-to-follow bright line, if it's for possession with intent to deliver, trafficking, delivery, maintaining a vehicle, that the police officer can, taking into consideration the other circumstances, particularly as you described them in your hypothetical, it's reasonable for the police officer to conduct at least a Terry frisk, if not a more serious search?
Because there's going to be an awful lot of people whose rights are violated. If my stepson has a possession of marijuana charge, and he's in my car, and they go with possession of marijuana.
But Mr. Hurley, when you say there's going to be a lot of people whose rights are violated, that begs the question. If we conclude that that's a reasonable search, given those circumstances, nobody's rights violated, right?
Well, I'm taking it the other way. Reasonableness includes how many people are paying the price in terms of the rights being violated. It's a adjustable thing. If 1 out of 10, if one out of 10 drug dealers has a gun on his associates in his car, and 99 out of 100 people were going to be violated, you'd say that's not reasonable. There has to be something that the state moves forward other than this big glossy picture. Sometimes drug dealers have Confederates with them who aren't. How many times? Where's the empirical data? There isn't any empirical data.
Well, I guess there may not be empirical data, but there's still a risk factor there that isn't to be considered, is it not? And that is that one mistake could cost one police officer's life or serious injury to a police officer, and that's a risk that this bright line rule could avoid. And it's too serious a risk to consider these searches unreasonable, even if it's only 1 out of 100 that results in finding a gun on a companion.
And my bright line rule, I submit, would accomplish the same thing. As long as the officer can control the situation. If he can't control the situation, then he can justify with reasonable, articulable facts why it wasn't sufficient to do that. And he'll come in and say, this one person was fidgety. That made me nervous. I had to pat him down. This person was non-compliant. There was sweating, something going on. Something has to be given other than the fact you're just sitting in a car with these people.
And your point here with Henderson, I take it then, is that there wasn't anything added value to Henderson's situation. It's simply based on the fact he was an associate of someone for whom a drug warrant had issued.
Who was playing basketball, who looked a police officer in the face, who put a bag down, who put his hands there and stood quietly and did absolutely nothing. It is the worst case scenario for automatic companion. and there are a lot of Steve Hendersons potentially in the world. And obviously the state did it in this case, they're going to do it in other cases. And people's rights are being violated by the way it's being done. I don't know the red line. I just know the abuse that's going on, and that's why all of you are in the position that you're in to be able to figure it out if a bright line is appropriate.
Well, if I understand you correctly, you're suggesting that the line should be drawn at whatever is the lowest level of intrusion that could arguably secure the police officer and get control of the situation. Why does the police force have to be at the risk that goes with having chosen or being stuck with only the most minimal intrusion when that still leaves open the possibility that there's going to be harm?
Well, the way I look at it, in the vast majority of cases, the police officers are going to be allowed to do the pat-down because you've got a single police officer, you've got a darkened car, you've got people. There's things going on in these cases all the time. So it's few and far between that you're going to have a police officer who's not adequately protected because he's going to be able to articulate why he felt it was necessary to do more than this. But in this case, clearly, there is nothing to suggest 19022 could not have been complied with. There's superior police manpower. They are deployed appropriately. For all we know, all three people were secured in some fashion without difficulty. All were compliant, broad daylight, cars are blocked in. This is a situation which cries out for reasonableness, that is, the most minimal circumstance that adequately protected the police. Now, this is a unique animal, this particular case.
What's your understanding of the record with regard to the visibility of the gun? As I read the record, he patted him down, and there seems to be something about he didn't know whether he felt the gun or saw the gun, but it was readily apparent in a short amount of time that the gun was there. Do we know if the gun was visible or he just felt it?
There's two passages that come to mind. The first one, he says, "I felt the gun and looked down in the pocket." It does not indicate it was a deep jacket pocket. Does not indicate that had he not done that, because I was thinking about inevitable discovery. It says in the pocket, there is no indication whatsoever that the gun butt extended beyond the line of the pocket so that he would have seen it in any event. He then said simultaneously, and I said perfectly simultaneously, and he said, well, closely simultaneously, but both times that he told the chronological story, he said that he felt and then saw, and then as he was giving his summary, he said, I felt the gun, and I pointed out, you felt the gun. When he talked to the other police officer, he told the Meadows that he found it during the course of a pat-down, which is a touching situation. So the fair inference that is to be drawn, and certainly it's the state's burden to discount it, is there was a touch, feel, and then an immediate looking down, because he said his eyes were at the shoulder level, left hand on the left shoulder, right hand going down, felt, and then looked down, which common sense would tell you is the case as well.
Well, in her opening, the prosecutor said, and I wrote it down, quote, felt, then looked down and saw a gun, close quote.
That is correct.
So it doesn't appear to be a factual dispute about that.
Simply that the trial judge did not adopt a bright line rule. He just declined to adopt the automatic companion rule and said that the totality of the circumstances do not show reasonableness for the search.
Exactly. And I'm simply saying,
if we affirm that, that's not adopting a bright line rule.
I agree. I'm simply pointing out because I thought you'd all like to know what's going on out there and just telling you there may be a thought process at some point of a bright line rule to cure what is going on there. You never see it because what happens, typically the state is smart enough to say, how would you like the diversion program? So you have a kid that's been illegally searched and you say, you want to go for an appeal all the way to the state Supreme Court and spend with me $1,000? Or would you rather just take the diversion program? So these things get just pushed under the covers because of the simple way of handling cases, but it's out there.
Again, so trying to focus on the practicalities here, let's hypothesize that a police officer asks the person to put his hands on the car, and as you say, that would secure the situation, right?
Sometimes.
Okay, well.
Probably not most of the time, but
okay,
sometimes.
Fine. But then the police officer wants to know who this person is. And the person says, my name is Tom Jones. And the officer says, okay, I need to see identification. At which point, you're allowing this person, or the police officer will be allowing this person who's got his hands on the car, to put his hand in a pocket, which may contain a gun. Right?
Depends on who the person is and the circumstances surrounding it. If it was somebody that looked like me, probably shouldn't use it myself, and I don't want to bring you into it. If it was somebody that looked like the prosecutor, I would assume the police officer could feel confident this person is going to hurt me, get your identification out. There's a lot of seedy-looking people. The police officer is going to say, give me, where's your wallet? And could simply go get the wallet. Again, it depends entirely on circumstances. And I'm not one to say, well, let's let the police be out there at their peril to protect rights. But on the other hand, there's just so much going on that there's a better way than, okay, you're with a drug dealer, a burglar, a domestic violence person. All of these people fall in these categories. Assault, domestic violence, sex offenders. It's a whole lot of people that are people on probation. You got a big population out there of people riding around that now have normal lives, children, mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, wives, spouses, girlfriends, that get patted down. The girls don't usually get it because they're not going to bring in a female. But you got an awful lot of patting down going on this so-called automatic companion, because that's what they're taught or that's what they believe on the street, as this police officer says. And he tells you, if this person had a Kevin Jones, Michael Jones, had a t-shirt on, I'm Michael Jones, he would have still done the same thing, because officer safety is utmost. They have taken it to the point that you're with anybody in this category and you say drug cases, that's this case, it goes far beyond drug cases.
Let me just ask you a factual question. There were three people that were stopped, correct?
Yes, correct.
There were three officers. So there was
five to six cars.
Five to six officers.
At least, that's what he said. He said at least five to six, and he mentioned there were five to six police cars.
Is it an undisputed fact that all three of the people who were stopped had been secured?
It is not mentioned, and since there was no information brought forth by the prosecution, one could assume if there was a disturbance over on the passenger side of the car, that would have been brought forth. The absence of it suggests to me that it is undisputed. Certainly, if somebody was creating a ruckus or any kind of disturbance or acting in any untoward fashion, Schiavi would have been asked what was going on over there. And all he said is, I couldn't hear what was being said there, so it sounds like it was a rather matter-of-fact situation. So there was superior police manpower, every exit was cut off, visibility was fine, and everything was planned. They waited there 2 hours. It was a very, very controlled situation, and this wasn't necessary. And under the other authority that we have, having to demonstrate a reasonable or articulable suspicion that the person was dangerous to him, the police or others, it just isn't there.
But if I understand your position, the police would have then arrested Jones and said, you know, we're arresting your friend, we have a warrant for his arrest, and the police should just assume that his two companions would just say, fine with us. You know, sometimes when you arrest people, the companions want to interfere with the arrest, or, you know, if the people are armed, they might do something if they didn't agree with their friend being taken away. But how are the police secure if they arrest someone and start to walk away and they never patted down the companions?
Well, it seems to me, again, and I'm trying to find a reasonable ground that protects the rights of the police from being hurt, protects the rights of the people. It's the word control, and control will be different in different circumstances. I can address this circumstance with somebody as compliant as Henderson was, and there was eyeball-to-eyeball contact. Facial expression looking at Schiavi after 15 years. He's looking at that man's eyes and the facial expression. He's watching the man put things down and stand like that. And I think under those circumstances, if Jones had been secured and put in a police car at that point in time, there's nothing to indicate that all of a sudden Henderson's going to say, okay, I got a gun in the bag, now I'm going to start shooting. And if we take that to its logical conclusion, then they would have had the right to search the entire vehicle, go through the bag, go through the entire thing. If we say that there was a danger, in this case, whether it being nothing else other than the fact you're playing basketball, that's all that we know of this. They don't even know their friends or associates. There are three guys who have apparently been playing basketball because it said there that were pickup games of basketball. If one is to assume that the police have the right to do everything necessary to convince themselves there is no weaponry around that Henderson might block or object to the arrest, then Henderson gets fully patted down, his bag gets patted down, his car searched. And that's just taking it too far under these circumstances.
Well, whether they saw them arrive together or not, is it fair to say that the state's representation is correct, that they were all leaving or appear to be leaving in the same vehicle together?
Yes. And it's also the fact that the information was that Jones would be playing basketball, not dealing drugs. And Schiavi admitted that even people who deal drugs, they have other activities, go to movies and do things that other people do. Again, that's all contextual here.
What a revelation. People that play basketball to take drugs.
And baseball, too, I'm told. If there's no other questions, I thank you for your interest.
In my brief moment to sum up, the state contends, bottom line, that there was reasonable, articulable suspicion to believe that Jones and or his companions were armed and dangerous. Based on that, it was reasonable to stop all three of the gentlemen getting into the car.
Well, before you get to that, say because. They had a reasonable, articulable suspicion they were armed because.
Because of the known quantity of drug trafficking and drug traffickers traveling with people who carried weapons. And it was a volatile situation. Whenever you're arresting someone and believing that his companions may well be armed, it's perfectly reasonable to stop and frisk. It's saying that putting someone's hands on the car controls the situation is simply not adequate when the police officer believes that that person may well be carrying a concealed weapon. There was no need to search the car. That Henderson could certainly not reach into the car in a brief moment and shoot the officer. He could, however, reach into an open pocket on his coat and turn around and fire at anyone. It was reasonable, given the officer's reasonable belief, that this person was more than likely armed and in this particular situation.
Thank you very much. Counsel, I can't say that you've made it easy for us, but you've nicely teed up the issues, and we appreciate your effort to take the case under advisement.
Please rise.